Good morning. Thank you. I know there were lots of parties last night, but that was really, really good. My name is Sloan Foster. I'm the VP of Marketing for HBMG and President of Digital Convergence Initiative. Today, we have some wonderful speakers on our panelists, some panelist members on our panel today. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, but to start, we've got Todd Bryant with Netcast from my right going that direction. And we've got Richard Galvin with Adobe, Brendan Mills with Ripcode, and Jeff Kramer with Polycot. So I'm going to let them give a little bit of introduction about themselves, and then we'll get into a couple of questions. It'll be a very interactive panel, so if you've got any questions, please just raise your hand in the middle of us talking. This is for you to be to learn and to ask the questions. So I'm just here to moderate.
Hi, I'm Todd Bryant. I'm CEO of Netcast HD. We specialize in enabling HD over the web. So right now we're 1.5 megabit HD using H.264 compression. And it's all streamable over broadband connections with interactive advertising, et cetera, et cetera. It's an engine that we've built for distributors, independent filmmakers, television companies that want VOD services, et cetera. Your turn. Really long introduction.
Good morning, guys. I'm Richard Galvin. I'm the product manager for Flash. I don't think I have to explain that part, right?
But, I don't even know what Flash is.
Little background. I also, for a while there, I was also the evangelist for Adobe for our video streaming solutions and video technology. So if you have any questions, by all means, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great. My name is Brendan Mills. I'm CEO of Ripcode. Ripcode is an Austin and Dallas-based company that specializes in video transcoding. We make an appliance for high-volume transcoding, especially focusing on the move to mobile video and to IPTV. So we do a lot of things like very high-volume video transcodes. Our customers include people like MySpace. So thanks. Look forward to the conference here.
Hi, I'm Jeff Kramer. Is my mic on?
Yeah. You can just pull it closer.
Hello. We're an Austin-based Rails developer. We do social media sites. One of our recent launches is MindBytes, which is a instructional video marketplace. We're doing Flash and iPod-compatible video for them. So,
First question I've got this morning is, many of us are familiar with the emergence of H.264, and which promises better compression than the current MPEG-4 technology. What is the status of this in mainstream video distribution?
I guess I'll start that one off since we had little to do with putting it out there. Obviously, most of you already know that we added the H.264 codec into the Flash Player as of Flash Player 9 Update 3. And I think as of, that was right around the December timeframe. As of then, we don't have specific numbers yet, but calculated, it's probably our penetration with that Flash Player is probably around 33, maybe 40% already on the total penetration of Flash. So penetration of H.264 right now is actually quite high. Whether or not they're necessarily using that codec or not, actually a lot of people have the capability of displaying that content. So I think it's pretty healthy.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's very healthy. H.264, definitely the Adobe supporting in Flash has been a very strong, I guess, sign that H.264 is emerging. But also, again, with the iPhone in particular, the iPhone almost exclusively uses H.264, and especially not only with Apple TV, but the iPhone itself. So all the YouTube videos that you see on the iPhone are H.264, all the iTunes store is H.264. And
getting a little feedback.
So I think it's definitely emerging, and it's definitely the heir apparent to video codecs going forward. So, and in addition, what you're seeing today with H.264 is just the beginning. I mean, the codec that's in use is basically what's called a baseline profile. So there are advanced profiles of H.264 available, and also something called SVC codecs as well. So H.264 has a lot of legs to it. You're only seeing kind of the tip of the iceberg for the capabilities today. And I think you'll see it, you know, emerge, and not only with all these devices such as the iPhone and the Adobe Player, but you're also going to see it penetrate the broadcaster segment, which today almost exclusively uses MPEG-2. They are starting to take on H.264 AVC as a broadcast element, and you're going to see this, you know, basically go across the board over the next 5 years.
Yeah, with the H.264, at least what we found is the ability to compress data more efficiently than any other codec that we've been used in the past. It also gives us the flexibility to go in and change the codec and really manipulate it to where it'll do the things that we need it to do. One of the things that we have seen is that we use high profile instead of the baseline and main, and the quality improvements are about 150% from going from baseline up to high profile. And it's also resolution independent to a certain extent. We've done 4K and 2K for the film industry, along with 1080p, 720p, and all the way down the line. So it's a very flexible codec. The other good thing is like they said, the broadcasters are adopting it as well. So once you as a distributor encode your stuff to an H.264 standard, typically it can be basically purposed several different ways. It can be over the broadcast airwaves, streaming into the home, over VOD services, retranscoded into the iPhone standard or whatever. So I think it's going to be the de facto standard going forward. It's the Blu-ray of the video codecs.
You actually bring up my next question, which is, what is the likelihood we'll be able to achieve better compression with than H.264 while still maintaining the high video quality, visual video quality? I think you touched on it, Brendan, as far as the legs that this has. What do you see happening in the next evolution?
There'll always be a new video codec. H.264 is just the latest in a long line of that, and it's really just the algorithm code that is improving. H.264 is the most complex video algorithm ever made. And not only is it the best that's available right now, but it's also the hardest to process. It's a very heavy lift for today's processors to encode and then to also decode the codec. So as time goes on, the algorithms and the software coding is actually getting much, much better. And so H.264 is the latest example of that. But there'll be other codecs past H.264 as well. But this is probably the biggest revolution in video codecs in quite some time, and it really is the only codec that's going to have enough legs to really overcome MPEG-2 in the broadcaster space. MPEG-4 had the opportunity, but it never really got there to the extent that H.264 will.
Do you think that H.264 will be the holy grail to really revolutionize IPTV and getting it into the mainstream, or do you think it's going to take another iteration of technology?
I don't think the codec will have anything to do with it, per se. It's a means to an end, really. It's about the holy grail to getting IPTV or distributed content is, or ubiquitous content, is really about the user interface and the service itself. The video codecs is one element of it. I don't know most laymen who can really tell the difference between MPEG-4 and H.264 today by looking at it. What it means to the user is essentially, great video on a number of different devices and only getting better. What the iPhone has done for the user interface is really much more compelling as an industry marker than just the development of the codec.
Content's still king. I mean, obviously, if it looks great, even better, but I think we all agree that we'll rather look at downgraded, low-quality video as long as it's what we want to see versus something we don't want to see, as long as it looks good. So it's all about the content.
Yeah, YouTube uses Sorenson today, and Sorenson is literally 10 or 15 years old. So people have taken Sorenson, and actually today YouTube is the most highly watched video stream or video download service today. So obviously even Sorenson is good enough to some extent, and it really is about the means to get the service to you and the content and the ease of use.
And I have to disagree a little bit. I think the problem with video on the web right now is the quality of it. It is subpar. It doesn't look good on a HD television, and that's what we're all here for. If you're a filmmaker or if you're an interactive maker, you want the highest quality video at the lowest bit rate you can, and that's where I really think that H.264 is going to push us over the edge there. 2.5 years ago when we started our company, the best video we could have was about 3 megabit. Now we're down to 1.5 at full 720p resolution. And it looks better than Blu-ray. At least we've been told it looks better than Blu-ray, which means that we can make that jump, that leap between your notebook or your PC and your HD television. And that's the big key. And I think that's the kind of quality that you're looking for to basically proliferate video, either in the IPTV network, streaming, or VOD services.
Well, that actually brings up one of my questions, which is when the TV and the computer converge, we won't have to, it seems like there are some camps say we won't have to make a choice between watching video on our computer or watching video on our TV, and you're saying that that actually is the case.
Well, I think it's the ultimate future. In fact, if there's any telco and cable people out there, they're probably going to get pissed off. But I think that they're going to turn into a broadband providers, and you're going to get all your content over the web. And it'll be a big, huge nightmare for a while until the video searches and the services come out to where you can find the content that you want when you want it, but it'll be all on demand. Except for live programming like sports and stuff like that.
Which actually, I think, brings up a point. I think one of the questions you asked is, like, what do we see with the H.264? And I totally agree that, obviously, improvements in the quality are ongoing every day. I mean, that's something we're going to continue seeing. But we also see that around the container for MPEG-4, not just around the codec, you know, there are advancements. For example, for metadata, there's a big push right now for temporal metadata that's part of the container. That's not really a codec, but it's more part of the whole package. And there needs to be improvements in that area to make it more, I guess, searchable or findable. And so there's a lot of areas around, not just around the coding, that require improvements.
High definition video produces 3 to 4 times the amount of data as standard definition video. How are we going to be able to distribute large amounts of high-definition video over the existing IP networks? And what about over wireless networks? We've talked about mobile, but let's also talk about the other Wi-Fi and traditional wireless networks that will help with deploying and distributing ubiquitous content.
Well, I definitely think that's one of the problems about H.264 and these higher level of compression is not only the processor complexity of encoding and decoding them, but also the massive amounts of files. And you know, you look at what the Apple TV does, and you select your content and you wait for it to be downloaded. And the one thing about these high definition content opportunities now is that it's going to push all the networking layer even higher. I mean, we're going to be required to do higher and higher broadband capabilities to the home to support these higher resolutions that are coming in. So it all drives back and forth, right? In some cases, the network gets out ahead of the content, and right now, almost the content is ahead of the network, and the network is catching up to this demand of size and the complexity of HD programming.
Well, the one thing I've noticed is that the Time Warners of the world, and we're Time Warner here, in case you guys are from out of town, and AT&T, they'll give you only enough bandwidth that makes you buy their service. So you have to kind of work around that. And that's what we kind of did too, is we looked at it as where's the bottleneck. And the bottleneck is that last mile to the end user. And I think the average in the US is about 3.6 megabit downloads. So you had to get below that threshold so you could at least supply 2 HD streams. And that's where we kind of came up with the 1.5 megabit service. What's interesting is if you're over in Japan or South Korea, you can get like 100 megabits for like $10 a month. So we're way, way behind. And it's really, it's the telcos and the cable companies that hold that bandwidth back.
Well, to their credit, just the AT&T U-verse alone, they have a 25 megabit per second connection. And, you know, they're really focusing on about a 6 megabit per second per stream. It gives you at least 3 to 4 connections in your house for live programming. So the quality of and the speed of broadband is going up even today. So UVerse is it's a 25 megabit service. It's got several hundred thousand users up and running today, and you're going to continue to see that improve over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I think I'm being the devil's advocate, but also that is a closed network. It's not an open network, and I think there's a lot of people out here that want to become their own broadcasters, and that's what we have to enable, right? So yeah, I see that. So that's what we're up for, and I think that's what Adobe's up for, is to try to enable that capability for the, you know, the average Joe to get out there and produce content and make it available for everybody.
I've got a couple more questions, but before I move to those, does anyone have any questions in the audience that this has triggered, any sort of thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's difficult because you hear of the net neutrality and all that other stuff, and I think there'll be a big, huge uproar if that goes through. But I think it'll be a thing over time. I think they also have to play fair with their networks. One of the things we built with our engine is a network monitoring client that allows us to monitor how much goes over whose pipes and be able to report that back to, like, a Time Warner or a, you know, whoever is supplying the broadband to that end user, and then be able to give a revenue share model built into that so that you can play fair with them and they won't get too ticked off. But it's only a matter of time, and I'm not saying it's going to go away. I think the telcos and cable operators have a have a vested interest to keep us at bay. That's why they make billions and billions of dollars. But it'll finally open up, probably not in my lifetime, but maybe in our kids' lifetimes.
It'll open up sooner than that. I mean, there's no way that you can really block access over the internet long term. I mean, I don't think users will stand for it. And even today, it's one thing to say net neutrality on cable and DSL internet, but even on mobile phones today, the blocking that's occurring on mobile access is really a lot worse than it is even on terrestrial based, and something called geo blocking. And you know, for example, you know, Google Maps doesn't work in all territories. In Canada, it's blocked in favor of local mapping services. And so, you know, this is a problem, and I don't think users will stand for it long term. And I think that in the next two to three years, there'll be, you know, very specific, you know, federal and national policies in place that prevent that kind of blocking.
I know they have big, deep pockets, and they like to pay off congressmen, so it'll be around for a lot longer, unfortunately, just because of that political play.
Yeah, look at digital boxes. I think got extended a couple of years, right, too, from analog to digital. So,
well, the FCC is very close to making some rulings on net neutrality, so I think you'll see some positive things for users, you know, within the year, actually.
Good. I've heard personally of some technology. There's one in San Antonio, which is where I am, called BroadRamp, which achieves tremendous compression rates and then, of course, uses Flash Player to play high-quality video with no latency or downloads. What other innovations such as this are going to increase the speed and simplicity of video downloads, do you think?
Well, we had kind of mentioned SVC, and if you guys, it's pretty brand new to the H.264 specification, but basically allows you to have several resolutions built into one in code. What that's going to do for us is to allow you to have something like a 480p signal coming into your home, so it'll start immediately. Then as your broadband pipe opens up, it'll actually start increasing the resolution because you may have a 480p versus a 1080p, you know, et cetera, et cetera, into the stream. So that'll actually help that latency, I think, over time, too.
From our perspective, obviously, you know, we're continuing to try to innovate and make the streaming technology a little more effective. Also, the codec, you know, the codec is going to get better. And like I said, it may be H.264 in the future. It may be a derivative, maybe a completely different codec. Obviously, you know, compression technology, performance of the compression is going to have to improve. On the streaming side, there's a lot of things that can be done from a streaming perspective on the server end to enhance the quality, also and crunch the numbers even more.
Adobe's making a lot of improvements in what you talked about, the right container and an FMS, and what you're doing to shorten the latency on start times of streaming. I mean, you know, the codec's one thing, but it's all about the stuff around the codec, which then, you know, starts to really improve performance.
You're seeing the DaVinci chip, such as TI released. Is that going to impact how you distribute video and how proliferated your video becomes?
I mean, I think so. I mean, it's hard to say yes, Obviously, it's definitely one of those technologies that is very promising. I think there's a lot of great things that are, and that's just one of many. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of great technologies that we're kind of either we're working on or we're working with. But honestly, it comes down to really the people out there. They pick a technology. Normally, somebody finds an interesting one, they pick it, and that's the one that that goes out. So. It's really about offering different choices and making sure that the users have choice in which one they want to go with.
Well, speaking of that, the market is being segmented, for example, between streaming video for viewing on computers versus downloading a video and viewing on televisions. Where do you think the growth areas are, and what do you think the limiting factors are?
PCs versus televisions? Well, I mean... What does it matter in a few years? It'll be the same thing, right? And one thing that the writer strike showed was that their eyeballs were moving from the TV set to the PC. I mean, it was very well empirically documented that was the case. And more and more, just with the availability of content on the internet, it's stealing people's eyeballs from TV sets. And so really that means the two platforms have to merge. And that's what you're seeing on a number of different fronts today. And those have to be, you've got to be able to go back and forth between the two technologies. And, that we're going to be able to, use our TV set in the living room in the same way that we're using our PC in the office in the next 5 or 10 years. They should not be two separate worlds.
Now, the other interesting thing that I see is that us as a human being consciousness, we're very, I want it now. So I think that's the other issue is that download and then play is going to go away from just pure streaming, and that will stream into your HD television, and you'll have that same experience, and you'll be able to get all the content that you want, hopefully with like Google searches and the different other companies that are out there that are helping to find and meta tag and the rest of the things that we're all working on to try to help finding and proliferating your video much more efficiently.
Are you guys ready for Google being your TV guide UI interface with banner ads and ad click software? And
I hope not.
That's what you'll be seeing.
I was just getting ready to ask, how does advertising affect the video, the move that's happening in video, where video affect the advertising?
I mean, just speaking from the engines that we built into our delivery vehicle, is that I think we built both of them, the VOD side where you can pay for your content that's commercial free and then also have it corporately sponsored. And I think the advertising companies themselves, even their people like BMW and some of the progressive video kind of centric companies, are really pushing for an internet presence, and they really want that interactive media market. So I think it's really going to be up to the customer, us, that we want to sit there. Do we want to pay a dollar for a piece of content, or would we rather have it for free and get some sort of demographic profiling of that and see a commercial for, Crest toothpaste or Starbucks or whatever before you get to watch your show.
Okay. So, any questions popped up in the audience? I'm actually running low on my list of 15 or so here.
Sure. There's different sides to the DRM. For a lot of companies, they're obviously concerned about their content. They don't want people just taking it. Obviously they're protecting their investment, and so obviously that make they're looking to any company, like us and many other companies, to be able to protect their content, find ways of protecting their content. What's interesting is that sometimes it's not just. Some people are really concerned about that's really their concern, protecting content, make sure that no one steals it. in other areas, it's literally just a checkbox for the lawyers to leave them alone. And so, they actually just, they ask you, do you have DRM? And you try to explain to them, no, I know, that's fine. We just want to know you have it. And they check it off and off they go. Whereas other people are really concerned about will it protect my content? How secure is it? All these different things. So, you have to deal with it from both ends. But just to tell you from our perspective, obviously, we've been working on DRM for some time now with Flash. Obviously, for a long time, we didn't have DRM. But with our latest version of Flash Player and our Flash Media Server, we're now incorporating DRM. So it's just, like I said, it's difficult to provide some numbers on how like effective it is. I can see a video camera sitting right there. And how effective is DRM when you can literally sit in front of your monitor with a video camera? You know, all the technology in the world doesn't protect that. So, you know, sometimes I really don't understand what people are looking for, but, you know,
they may not either.
I mean, my feelings on DRM is twofold. One is if you make it, if there's value in something, somebody will pay for it, whether it be a corporate sponsor to get your eyeballs to look at a commercial, or you yourself just want to buy the content. As long as it's fairly priced and it's not like a CD that comes with no lyrics anymore and it's $20, you know, that's when that's shifted over and said, well, screw this, I'm just going to go steal it. And I think that's true of anything on the web, but also DRM, I think, is going to go away as well, just because of the fact of streaming is so efficient right now, and you can protect your streaming content. And anyway, people, when they do buy a piece of content, they don't want to just watch it on one computer. They want to watch it on wherever they're at whatever time. So make it cost effective to stream that to whatever device they want. So you buy something for $10 or whatever. You can stream it to your home computer. You can stream it to your notebook computer when you're out on the, out on a business trip. You can stream it to your little iPhone. You can stream it to wherever. And if as long as it's cost efficient, that's the way to do it. And I don't think DRM's. And the other good thing about this is without a DRM, and you can stream it anywhere, if you do lose your computer or upgrade it, you still have your content somewhere on the cloud.
Yes.
Go ahead. Someone. Speaking of cloud computing, how do your technologies interface or play into that or enhance that?
Excuse me. Well, I talked to the device guy down there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for us, IP is IP. So whether it's off a unicast network or a cloud network or a peer-to-peer network, it really doesn't matter. But we are seeing some interesting things going on in cloud computing, and I think it's all part of the process here. And I think you'll see, in some cases, we see our customers using CDNs. In some cases, we see them using peer-to-peer networking. In some cases, they're virtualized networks. And we don't see necessarily a winner in that space in the content world yet. We see a real conglomeration. So it's hard to say if cloud computing in particular is going to be the predominant factor. I think they're all going to be an important piece of that.
Well, Adobe's given you tools to stop that, and it's very effective. In fact, we put it into our engine just to make sure that, you know, if you download it, all you do is you get the little player icon. That's about it. So you really can't steal it anymore. Now, obviously, there's going to be hackers out there that are going to try to grab it again. And so, you know, we'll have to keep working around that. But again, I think it's the value proposition. If you can get something at a decent price that you can stream to any device you have, whether it be your mobile phone or your Apple TV or whatever you're using, there's the big key. And there has to be some value there that you think is worth paying for or having somebody else pay for it.
All DRM is breakable.
Yep.
It's mainly just a deterrent, really. And how much do you want to burden the process of distributing the content versus how much deterrent you want, right? And it's unfortunate. And we wish it wasn't there.
Anyone have any additional questions in the audience? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think if you talk to any video search, you know, portal, whether it's Yahoo or AOL or whether it's Google, I mean, the the grand vision is to be on your TV set being the TV guide portal. It's all going to be based off video search algorithms. I mean, that's the only way that you can get to a billion pieces of content is to have video search algorithms. And so what you're seeing today from Yahoo and guys like VTAP and a bunch of these others, you know, nascent video search engines is the genesis of what the UI is going to be down the road for selecting content. And if you think about it today, and I don't have specific numbers from these customers, but or these operators, but YouTube, I believe, has over 75 million pieces of content, right? Wow. And so, you know, that's just at YouTube. You go to MySpace, you go to the other portals, and just think about the how much content is really out there. And then that's not even hitting the Hollywood vaults, right, or the broadcaster vaults. So, I mean, you're really the only way to access that. You can't put it in a linear user guide form. You have to have a search capability. And so these guys, as the TV and the computer merge, those portals are the future TV guides.
I think there's some other technology that Adobe's been developing, and we're Adobe developers, so we get to see all this stuff early, is the Adobe Media Player, which allows you to subscribe to RSS feeds that'll help find the content that you're wanting. So you may go up to a YouTube and they'll be AMP enabled and you'll be able to subscribe to the stuff you want. I think also demographic profiling will help. It'll also, some of the algorithms and the analytics that are going to be, that people are developing now, will help kind of profile you as, hey, I'm a sci-fi guy, I like to watch sci-fi stuff, or I'm a big bocce ball sports kind of guy and I want to watch that, and it'll feed that kind of information to you, and then you can either choose to watch it or not, and that's the big key. And I think all of that's going to evolve over time.
So obviously there are several strategies. I think what you're talking about, which is the ability to go out there and search, just search the web for all the pieces of content. I think everybody will love that. Just right now it's very, very difficult. There's no data to look for. I mean, in video, it's very, you know, it's very obscure. No one's putting data in the video to make it searchable. So the approach for AMP was kind of the other way around, which is instead of like going out there, you bring it in. Right. You let them come to you. And so you have a little more control. It's a little more searchable. It's a little more accessible. We'd love to make it so that you can just go out there and search all the content and just you find everything. But you have a lot of challenges with metadata. You have a lot of challenges with not only the technology around it, but just the workflow. Someone needs to inject that data.
Yeah, the issue is all search engines today are textual-based search engines or queries, right? So that's how they find stuff. And in a video, there's no text embedded unless someone has, you know, made the metadata very comprehensible. And that can also be tagged and manipulated. What the new technologies going forward will be is for you to start running the capability of or running an encoder or decoder capability, which allows you to then run an algorithm which detects the face or the location or the scenery within the video itself. And those are technologies that are emerging today. A lot of this technology came out of places like DARPA or the defense contractors where they could, you know, identify tanks and whatnot. Now you can take that and you can take it to recognizing faces. If I want to see all the videos with Barack Obama, and this algorithm could go and find that video for you. And as that's a very, very complex thing to do, and it's still, you know, 5 or 10 years away, but the search engines will encompass that capability to actually search within the encode of the video itself for specific visual references.
Why is it 5 to 10 years away? Because it seems to me if the technology exists, and I know that it does, as you spoke of DARPA, and there's the algorithms that exist.
There aren't cost-effective processors today that can, for example, if you there are all kinds of filtering methodologies today, or companies that are developing algorithms to detect porn or detect copyrights. And the actual algorithms to run against those videos are so taxing on a processor that it could literally take, you know, if it's a 10-minute video, it could take 100 times the length of the video just to process that and detect that visual representation. So we have to have a leap in processing performance. And you guys mentioned the DaVinci processor from Texas Instruments. You know, there's got to be a higher step function to get processing capable of doing that type of thing, and then get it down to the price where we can stick it into an iPhone.
Well, I think not only the processor, just accuracy.
Right.
I mean, right now let's you know the technology is there. It's just not very accurate. Yeah. I mean, you know, how effective is it? You type in Barack Obama, you get Hillary Clinton instead because it just didn't recognize it properly. So accuracy is a big problem. I mean, yeah. We've been struggling with accuracy just on voice recognition.
Exactly.
And that's a much older technology. So until we get video recognition,
that's just voice. Yeah.
Not just voice. I mean, video recognition is gonna take years to get to a point where it's really functional.
If you look at like right after 9/11, everyone was going, oh, facial recognition, so we can get the bad guys. And, you know, you haven't heard much about that because they found out that the technology was only like 30% accurate. So we didn't want to start pointing people and going, oh, you're a terrorist and you're this and that and the other thing. And it does take a long time to process. So it's a very complex problem.
Yes.
Oh, sure. I think everybody is looking for the day you can just throw video into this process and it comes back and caption is automatically done for you because it recognizes the voice. I think there's several groups that are working on some of that. Obviously, Adobe is really interested in that type of technology as well. Once again, it just comes down to
resources.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it comes down to making sure that it's effective, that it's reliable. Two, that it's cost effective. And three, that it actually that the technology is put in a place where it's part of a workflow that makes sense, and it's not going to be taxing to the user who tries to, like, once again, it's about injecting metadata. And even if you have to wait till the end, here's the problem: if you wait till the end to inject the metadata, it's costly, and so most people don't want to do it. So it has to be a whole workflow that starts early in the process of creating that content, not just toward the end. So there's a lot of challenges. From technology, from workflow, from just from a lot of different areas.
Storing all that. Imagine every video, every broadcast recorded not only in the video form, but also dumped into a text, a searchable. All that's just an amazing amount of storage processing. It's truly remarkable to think about all the things you have to record just to get to this capability. Oh, you capture voice recognition.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. All those things are definitely things that people are working on. It's just the complexity of getting from A to B. I mean, H.264 is such a leap in encoding technology, and to get to the things that we're now talking about is a 100-fold increase in the complexity. But it's happening. It's just it's amazing when you get down to the details and the math associated with just doing H.264, how complex it is.
There's got to be a value to that metadata tagging as well. I mean, if you look at DVD production, when it started coming out and people said, oh, I can make money off of DVDs, all of a sudden you got chapter markers, you got all the special stuff going into them, and the tools like from Adobe came out to help you, put the chapters in and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's what you're going to see is a lot of the post-production environment's going to change and allow you to meta tag stuff while you're editing and producing your content. And then it's there and it's captured. And it'll be part of that user bits that go out with the little video so that it can be tagged and searchable and all that other stuff. But it's going to take some time.
There's no standard for metadata. I mean, every codec, every player, every container, all that has a different form for metadata. It's very complex to map metadata from one process to another. For example, YouTube doesn't even use, they use their own metadata forms for capturing that. So
obviously we've been working on this problem for some time. Adobe has XMP for metadata. Really was designed around putting metadata around a file. You start talking about metadata and video and audio, it's a very different problem because it has to be temporal. It has to be data for every, and you can be configured for every second, for every minute, for every 10 minutes. You have to inject data that makes sense. And once again, it's not that it's not going to go there. It will. It's just going to take a little time to get it right. And to make it, like you said, there has to be some sort of standard, some sort of way of everybody knowing how to read this data. Every container stores data differently. MPEG-4 stores it differently. QuickTime
stores it
differently. You know, our own FLV container stores it differently. And so, you know, it's not about like just coming up with one format. It's just about making sure that the technology works in a way that you can just go to each one of these containers and read it properly. So, once again, it's just a matter of time. We definitely see it, you know, getting better. Like your question about captioning. I didn't want to sound like a naysayer. It will get there. It's just going to take a little time. That's all. Yeah, I think as a platform, you're right. I mean, we've allowed it for some time, but once again, it's the users making that stride to put it out there. But I think once again, the real challenge is getting people to really put the data to make sense, to make it value, add value to that data, or to the content. And I think right now that's one of the biggest problems. I mean, how many of you guys have gone to YouTube and tried to search for? If you don't know the title of the movie, good luck trying to find the content, because I think the average tag for a YouTube video is like, I think three pieces of text, and that's because probably one person put like 500 on one video and everyone else has zero. So it's just difficult to find content. And
metadata is only as good as the inputter.
And you shouldn't be seeing movies on YouTube anyway, right?
Right. and of course, I think right now we're satisfied with saying, you know, find me videos of, you know, so-and-so. Right now we're satisfied with that. But I think people are looking for the ability to say, no, I want, find me a video, or find me the scene where, you know, this person says this to, and you want there to be an ability to search for that, that specific type of content. And we're just not there yet. And hopefully that's what we're working on, and we'll get there soon.
Yeah, we've got some software that allows you to annotate frame by frame, and we designed it for the post-production environment mainly. But that same concept could go out to the public, to where if you're watching a movie and you just want to meta tag it for some reason, or if there's some real value there where you're getting paid to do it at a home project, then that could happen as well. So it's something to hopefully, you know, will happen in the future.
I thought I saw some other hands in the audience. We have about 15 minutes. I'd hate to cut it short because it's a really good information.
One of my favorite actually is Hulu. I'm a big fan of Hulu.
Hulu.
Yeah, it was NBC's
Portal. Universal. I think they've done a great job. And once again, I'm a little bit biased. They are using our technology, but even if they weren't, I'd still be a big fan just because of the content. They've done a really good job of creating a really nice interface. It's really clean, real simple. It's easy to find content, which is a big part, and they have great content. That's really the thing. You're not going to go somewhere if there's not great content. HULU.
.com.
And I think right now it's still by invitation.
Yeah, it's in beta.
It's in beta. Do you have to? Oh, there is? Okay. So you can get all their video. Okay.
For free.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but once again, it's great. I mean, yes, they did a great job. It's real simple. The interface is nice. But they got great content. I mean, where else can you find the entire season, all the episodes of the A-Team? I mean, that's just great stuff.
Do they have different strokes, though?
Pity the fool.
I don't have to check on that one. But yeah, it's like I said, it's just exactly what I just want to be able to go find video, watch it, and then you're done. So that's one of my favorite. There, I have other ones, but I'll let these guys.
Yeah, I think another one that did really well is ABC. If you go up to ABC's website, they've got a very unique interface. But also, I've seen, and my wife is one that watches Desperate Housewives on ABC.com. So it actually is pretty good video. They're getting there with the HD, but I think they've got a great interface too.
You know, I'm a big fan right now of mobile video, so video on cell phones. And so obviously, you know, the YouTube experience now on not just the iPhone, but mobile phones is interesting. There's a company called VTAP. I mentioned them earlier, VTAP.com, which is a video search engine for that can also be done on cell phones. And it just looks at all the content out there and will draw it down and in some cases transcode it for mobile phones. So I think the real interesting part to watch is how now the iPhone is been the trendsetter in this space, is all the large video guys and social networking guys moving to mobile. You're going to see a lot of announcements this year about guys like MySpace and others that are moving to mobile. That to me by the end of the year will be the big story.
Well, I sort of think we're in like the beginnings of the golden age of user-generated content. But in addition to empowering users, I mean, we have video podcasts that look as good as TV shows, which like 5 years ago that wouldn't have happened. But today, you also have companies like Whole Foods Market, which has great knowledge, but didn't have a good way to get it out to people. And they've got like 5 video podcasts now on a whole range of topics. And I think that is really cool, where if you have a brand and you're interested in a company, you can get more compelling content from them than you could have a couple of years ago.
No, go ahead. I would just want to let him know that we do see you.
Well, I didn't. Thank you.
Start of the blurring of the lines between what is the TV, what is the PC, right?
Yep.
Right, and also
they don't care about windowing, right?
My 2-year-old nephew points and goes, "iPod, we got a problem, or a good thing, depending on your perspective."
Yeah, if you look at our you know, the baby boomers, they were kind of you know, handcuffed to the television. That was their entertainment source, and our kids nowadays have a plethora of entertainment sources, and they're not chained to it anymore, and I've not been chained to the TV either. You know, you got TiVo, so you can record all the programs that you want, and or watch them on the web. And we're reclaiming our lives, so we're not sitting there from 7 to 8 having to watch a program. I've got to watch my program, and don't interrupt me. You know, you can have your own lives. You can do what you want to do, and watch content when you want to watch it, which the broadcasters they're starting to accept it, but they don't like it because the advertisers don't like it. So,
right. Hold on. We had a gentleman over here.
Well, the difference is that with Hulu, it's all their content. They manage it entirely. They're not aggregating video. I mean, it's easy to find because they make it that way. So that's really the big difference is, you know. Oh, you can't, but that means you only control your space. You know, they because they're NBC Universal, they have access to a lot of data. So it sounds like, you know, it looks like they have, you know, you can find anything you want, but it's like it's their content. Problem with doing it is really the question in the back was, I want to be able to go to Google, type in a quick search, and I want to find all the videos from anywhere that have, you know, match that. And that's the difficult part because you need a standard, you know, to be able to get all that content. Whereas Hulu, it's their content, it's their standard, it's on their page. But when you search, you're only searching for their stuff. So, you know, it's a very controlled environment.
But also the UI and the presentation is really nice. At the end of the day, I mean, we forget that, you know, the iPhone has been so great because it's just so easy to use, and the way they put the thought into how to search and all that piece. So, I mean, it's really a combination of that presentation layer, the Web 2.0 technologies around it, and then, you know, what we're talking about here is the searchability problems, the actual getting down the metadata, just that it's so difficult to actually pull out. Well, they own their own metadata. Yeah. Well, they control all their metadata on their content, where YouTube does not. The users actually input their own data on YouTube. And Hulu. Yeah, but still.
Right. Well, what Google does, well, that's sort of true. That's not entirely true. Like the Google video search, they're indexing other Flash sites, but they're indexing the text, which is the... Right. Right. But that's the easy 80%. Right. But they'll see what's on the page.
No.
It's not the video that's findable.
It's not the video that's findable. They have a database. They have a database, and they put everything in the database. You cannot find any there's no metadata in their video. It's all around their database.
And how they save the video in their database. I mean,
for them. Exactly. It works for them. But it's not going to work for everybody. It doesn't work for the world at large who wants to find the content.
Yes.
We have about 5 more minutes, and I've seen a couple of hands. So let me go ahead and get your question real quick and show of hands real quick with additional questions so I can get them before we wrap up. Just these two up front. Anyone else? Did you finish your point, sir?
Really defining the ability of people to develop open source codecs. There's a few, like
Well, we all have to do them. I mean, we all have to buy the royalties. One of the things that's not necessarily apparent in H.264 is that what will the MPEG LA licenses be after a couple of years? And
right.
You know, we're all kind of stuck behind the patent thing. I mean, we all have to pay them. And it just, you know, it's going to be the you know, for example, one reason that YouTube uses Sorenson as opposed to VP6 is the fact that the Sorenson license was cheaper than the VP6 license at the time. And that's why they've propagated so much Sorenson. So, you know, it really comes down to the cost, and that is one element that's got to be factored in the equation. If H.264 is really going to be successful, then, you know, the licensing has to be very affordable. And especially we're doing a lot in mobile phones and mobile video. And one of the things that we find that when we start to look at all these handsets, and by the way, there's 1,800 mobile phones out there, and each one having almost a different media player. And the last thing that the handset manufacturer looks at is the player and what codecs he supports, and they want the cheapest thing they can possibly get. So it's an issue, and you can't make the patents go away.
And I think the patents serve a purpose. I know that you all don't want to hear this, but by having a patent consortium that have all gotten together for H.264 and charging a minimal fee, there's a cap on them so that any distributor or developer, there is a cap per year. But it allows us to have a standards to work around. Mm-hmm. And without that standard, then we'd all be screwed on the metadata and everything else that's out there. Because now it'd be like, okay, I can't play this video because I don't have what codec do I need now and this, that, and the other thing. And by having a standardization, then you have companies like Ripcode that enables the encoding of that so we can get the content, and Adobe to standardize, and the rest of the developers to just standardize as well.
But if anybody out there creates a world-class encoder and decoder, and you give it away for free, call me.
Yeah.
We'll gladly take it. It's under development. It's not quite world-class yet.
Yep.
So there's the challenge.
Any additional questions to wrap up? I think the gentleman in the black shirt, did you have one real quick?
No, you're right. There are standards. So, you know, supposedly ways. Let me take that back. It's not a standard. It's a format specification to inject data into the container. That's really what it is right now. I can't call it a standard because no one's using it. So therefore, it's hard for me to call it a standard. But there is a specification. There are ways to inject data into every container. Once again, you know, people have to use it. Then of course once you have it in there, finding it, you know, are the search engines indexing or looking for it? So, you know, there's a lot of different there's some challenges there, but you're right, it's not being used. Not really. I haven't seen any real traction. Doesn't mean that it's not going to. I mean, there is a way to do. Obviously, it really comes down to tooling as well. You know, if there's tools out there to put the data and make it really easy and make it effective, then people will use it. So, and that's our challenge from Adobe's perspective. Our challenge is to make it as easy as possible to put data into the format. So that's something we're working on now. Exactly how we're going to do it, I can't give you exactly an answer yet, but that's actually our challenge, to make it really, really simple to put data into that content.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Todd, Richard, Brendan, and Jeff. Thank you very much for attending the panel today, and thank you for your questions. If you have any additional questions, the gentleman will be available briefly for some points.